This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Martha Deal, Harriet Williamson, and at the controls this morning, Jason Croft. In this hour of the show, this is the second hour of the show, we'll be spending some time talking a bit about the history of computing. And our guest for the program is a British computer scientist who, among other things, is a noted authority on the early history of computers, that is, before 1950. His name is Brian Randall, and he is visiting here the campus of the university, going to give a talk on some of his other areas of interests, which includes software fault tolerance and dependability. One of the things we know is that there are more and more computers around us. We're getting to the point where there are more and more devices that have computers in them, and the expectation is in the future that's only going to increase. Those computers will be linked up. They're going to be running probably all the time, and if that is the case, they'd better work. And that is one of the kinds of things that he is interested in his professional kind of work. He is an emeritus professor at the School of Computing Science at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne in the UK, and is here visiting. We'll give a talk. This is sponsored by the Information Trust Institute. It's their Distinguished Lecture Series, co-sponsored by the Coordinated Science Lab, the Department of Computer Science, and the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. And he'll be giving his talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the auditorium of the Beckman Institute, talking about dependable, pervasive systems. So if that's the kind of thing that interests you, you could stop by and hear what he has to say. Also here this morning, of course, questions, comments are welcome. We'd like to get people involved in the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. After he graduated university, he worked at English Electric, did work on compilers, also worked for IBM, and in 1971, and since has been at University of Newcastle upon Tyne. Again, questions welcome here. People want to be involved in the conversation, you can certainly do that. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for the invitation.
When you look at the history, just what little I've done, history of computing and also of the devices, things that we call computers, that is the mechanical devices, there would have been a time when if you talked about a computer, that meant a person.
That's right.
Who did computations. It was a mathematician or somebody who, either with paper and pen or with a slide rule or whatever the technology was, they crunched numbers. It was a human being who crunched numbers.
More likely a young lady working for a mathematician.
Indeed so. Very, very true. Indeed. There was a lot of women who were the computers, they were women. Having said that, you look back and there is a long way back in human history. People have been using devices, mechanical devices, to help crunch numbers. And, as early, we have pretty sophisticated devices like that as early as in the 1600s. Pascal built one and Leibniz built one. And, of course, we have the famous, your countryman, Mr. Babbage, did. I guess maybe a place to start would be to talk a little bit about those kind of mechanical number crunching devices and then what it is they do, but why it is that when we get to what is a true computer? I mean, what's really why is, Babbage might be sort of a grandfather of modern computing, but what he designed wasn't what we think of as a computer.
Well, let's just go to the names that you mentioned. Pascal, Blaise Pascal, was the famous French philosopher. He was more famous for many things other than his calculating machine. My wife was very scornful when she realized that I thought Pascal's main claim to fame was having invented a calculator. In fact, he was one of the greatest ever French philosophers. Pascal, if I remember correctly, when quite young, motivated by his father's task as a tax collector, set his very fertile mind to trying to build a mechanical machine which could do additions, basically. That was an amazing thing to try and do. It was even the notion of setting out to do that was a revolutionary idea, and he succeeded in building machines or having machines built under his direction, which could just manage to add a single digit to a multi-digit number and then another digit to that multi-digit number. But those machines were an object of awe and wonder, but they were not really practical. Certainly, it was they were not affordable in any way. And a number of those machines were built, and one of the reasons why they were built and why they still exist is that they were given as from one king to another, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They were royal gifts which were then put in a case and marvelled at, but certainly never used by the king to calculate his income tax.
Well, what we have these devices, and I gather over time they became increasingly sophisticated or capable of doing more and more complicated yeah. things, but that they were still essentially calculators to do what a large complicated mechanical machine that would do now what we have a thing that you could put in your pocket to do, and they had these basic functions, but that's all they would do.
The computers that we put in our pocket, or some decades ago, the computers that we would marvel at in a very large room, you could say represent the confluence of three things. Mm-hmm. The ability to do calculations, to do computations, to do addition and multiplication, subtraction, and so on, I mean by that. The ability to hold a lot of information, and the ability to follow instructions, a program, as we would call it. So you need to look at those three things and where those three ideas came from and when they came together before you see something which, if not physically, at least intellectually, is the computer as we now know it. Hmm. So Pascal's involvement was that of being very early on in the design of a machine to do simple calculations. Starting from, I suppose, the 1800s, the early 1800s, there was the idea of using punched cards to control complicated silk weaving looms. You can look back beyond that, even to the 15th century, and see complicated devices for playing music automatically, like ringing complicated church bell and tunes on church bells. That using a device that you still see in the little music boxes. I think you can still buy a little cylinder with a peg sticking out of it, which you wind up the clockwork mechanism, the cylinder turns. And that very simple device, because of having carefully positioned little pegs sticking out of the cylinder, plays a complicated tune. So that's the notion of a program. And then the silk weaving loom was using punched cards to control the sequence of the loom, but when in some cases they were using even thousands of cards if it was a complicated piece of silk weaving, and you could then start describing that as information. So those were, if you like, three of the currents that came together.
Yeah. So the serious thing about that was you have this loom, and it's one machine, but depending upon what kind of instructions you give it, you're going to come up with a very different product.
Exactly. It'll always be a piece of silk, piece of woven silk, essentially an infinite number of possible designs. But some of the designs they made, even in the early 1800s, were so sophisticated and so complex that if you see a picture of them now, they look like portraits, like lithographs.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about Charles Babbage and what it was that he did and why that it was significant.
It's a delight to talk about him because he undoubtedly is my hero. I'm Welsh, so I'm permitted to say that England is the place for eccentrics. And he certainly was an archetypical eccentric. He worked on a very large number of things. He was financially independent. His father had been a banker. He contributed. He invented many different things. He wrote on religion. He wrote a book on economics, which stayed in print well into the 20th century. But the relevant thing now is his interest in computing. He was motivated by a concern for the fact that the mathematical tables that people used to calculate and print so that other people could use them in their computations, he was interested in he was worried about the fact that those tables contained errors. Now, the notion of a mathematical table having errors in it doesn't sound very important. when that mathematical table was the nautical almanac, which was one of the most important things that anybody who was taking a ship around the world needed in order to be able to navigate, then you realise that that's really pretty important. Mm. So that was his motivation. And off and on, he spent much of his lifetime trying to design machines which could automate that task. And in so doing, in a period of about just 3 years in the 1830s, he, on his own, but with the support of draftsmen and so on, came up with nearly all of the most important scientific ideas which are embodied in the idea of, in our present notion of a computer. The idea of having mechanisms for automatic addition, multiplication and so on, holding multiple digit numbers, a machine that was programmed, as we would now call it, by punched cards. He realized, for example, how important it was for a machine to be able to do different things in different circumstances. We talk about conditional branching. A computer program is not just one linear set of instructions that the computer whizzes through to do what you want. Rather, it'll contain instructions like, is the value of some number positive or negative? Has this professorial salary been so altered that it's gone negative? Then you do something rather different about that, I hope, than if the salary is still positive. Mm. I joke, but I hope. So that notion of conditional branch, that was startling for him to not only to invent that, but to understand the philosophical significance about it. Mm. In writings which were to do with religion, he pointed out that a machine that had that ability, that conditional branching hidden inside it, could look literally miraculous to somebody who, seeing things from the outside, would not know it would do that. And he wrote a paper which I think had a title something like On the Nature of Miracles.
He had these ideas, and he had the idea for the device, but he wasn't truly able to realize it. And you correct me if I'm wrong on this history. And it was not so much because his ideas weren't right, but it was sort of a combination of either not having the money to do it or not having the technical skills of the people at the time maybe weren't capable of actually producing the machine to do what he wanted it to do, or perhaps it was some combination of those two things that he never really got to see the machine that he had in his mind actually work.
That's true. He designed a number of machines, and small parts of two of them were built, and they're amongst the most precious possessions in the Science Museum in London. Mm. One of those machines. Nothing like as complex as a full computer, as I've just described it. Nevertheless, was capable of adding a number of numbers together at the same time. And it was a machine which was part of one intended in producing mathematical tables. He used a considerable amount of his own money. I don't know, in modern terms, one would probably be talking at least tens of thousands of pounds or dollars. And he managed to get a grant from the British government. He got into disputes with the mechanical engineer who was working on this. And so that project essentially failed. But he was vindicated only a few years ago, mm-hmm. so to speak. I should point out that his work and the work of his mechanical engineer undoubtedly helped spur the whole machine tool industry and the whole of mechanical engineering. He left amongst many drawings a complete design for what we call a difference engine, and that was in the late 1840s. And in the 1980s, I guess it was, the Science Museum, motivated perhaps more than anything else, by an interest to find out whether that design was a good one, was complete, and whether it would have been a practical one in the 1840s. They commissioned, at a cost of, I suppose it was about $1.5 million, the building to that exact design of a complete difference engine. And that engine now works. It's a wonderful machine. It's probably something like about 7 foot high, 10 or 12 foot long. It has been completed now with an automatic printer, that through a donation from Microsoft. And it is occasionally demonstrated at the Science Museum, and it's a gleaming set of brass and steel, which will automatically generate and print quite complex tables in very neat format. And it completely vindicated Babbage, because it was carefully built only to the precision that was possible in 1840.
Yeah, so if we brought him back and set him in front of the machine, he would say, "See, I told you so."
Absolutely. They found just one or two errors, but it was clear that the quality of the design, the accuracy of the design, well, I'd like to know that we always did that these days.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Brian Randall. He's Emeritus Professor and Senior Research Investigator at the School of Computing Science at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne in the UK. He's a computer scientist. His particular interest is software fault tolerance and dependability, but he's also very interested in the history of computers, particularly the history of computers before 1950. He's here visiting the campus, and we'll give a talk later on this afternoon on his interest in dependable pervasive systems. But here we're talking a little bit about computer history, and if you have questions, you're welcome to call. We do have some. If you will go ahead and put on your headphones there, you will hear the callers. And we have three standing by ready to go. We'll start with the nearby community of Belgium, and that is line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, sir. I have 1,000 questions to ask you, but I'll try to be very concise here. Mr. Babbage built a phenomenal machine there, and did additions and stuff, and we call that a computer, but I think you really put it much better when you called it an engine, in that the way it really worked with gears and stuff. And today's computers, really, a lot of them are really just storage devices where they compare data. But in one of the very earliest computers we think about is clockworks, where we add time, which Harrison, which is another Englishman, very influential individual, developed the first clock that was able to keep very accurate time. And to step on to what I'm actually going to get at is, what do you consider the work of Danny Hillis today with some of his things, who is a very influential and very intelligent individual who has worked on lots of computer-type things and is also working on a project called The Long Now, which is a clock back to Babbage's situation, where it will work forever, or close to forever anyway, to keep track of time and keep track of all the various vagaries of time and how it is. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, you've brought several things together that I'm not sure that I would have. For example, to describe as a clock as adding time, I think, is a slightly confusing way of putting things. That's not in any way to denigrate Harrison's amazing contributions, effectively, to the art of navigation. Danny Hillis, I don't know if his latest work. Danny Hillis, in my book, was most famous for his work on the connection machine. That was a very highly parallel machine built some years ago.
Yes.
I remember a similar machine, DAP, being built in Britain a little before. But I can't comment on the time machine or whatever you called it.
Well, why I'd like to point out that a clock is a computer in some ways is because time, if we want to keep track of it like we do here on Earth, it's very complicated. You know, there's additions and fractions of seconds and stuff, and everything changes all the time over long periods of time. And so it really is kind of a computer in a way.
I'd put it the other way. Just about every computer now contains a little clock inside it, a tiny little clock based on a quartz crystal.
Sure.
That is just one sort of rudimentary component of a clock. And that is used so that, for example, you can write a program that will stop if it goes on too long. The clock has been ticking, and it's arranged that the clock will interrupt the program when something goes on too long, or if you're designing a program that has to interact in what we call real time, it is necessary for the computer not only to produce the right results, but to produce them, say, every 10 seconds, because a piece of machinery will go wrong if it's if it doesn't receive instructions at that rate. So you need a clock for that. But as I say, there one has the notion of a clock inside a computer. Certainly, the design of incredibly accurate clocks, the sort of thing that will be done at the National Bureau of Standards, I am sure that that involves computers, but that's getting way out of anything I know about. So I don't think that this line of discussion really leads us very far.
Well, I was referring back to also your aspect of Babbage and his mechanical situations. Because if you want to keep track of time over long periods of time, how do you do it? You can't always be sure that electricity is going to be here. The sun changes. If you see what I'm saying, it's a very complicated machine that's very much along the same sort of lines as Babbage's difference engine. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, the point about Babbage that I take away is that while the machines that he designed, they have the features that we think of as being essential to the computer as we think about it now. It may not qualify as a computer. We might say, well, really what it was a calculator, a calculating machine, but that his idea, it was as if he sort of saw this thing. He had this vision for what the computer would become that went beyond the thing that he actually built.
That's true, but the computer that we think of today will be a small thing that fits on your desk or something and is built out of transistors, and all you know about transistors, there's a very large number of them, mm-hmm. and they're inside chips and you can't even see them. Mm-hmm. Somebody who thinks of a computer like that, if they look at the sort of computer that was built in the 1950s or 1960s, would say, oh, that's totally different. Look, that's a huge machine I can walk inside. That's a machine that glows in the dark with all these glass tubes. When you turn it on, you start paying huge amounts for your electricity. There's a difference in technology, but in terms intellectually of what they could do, of the notion that they were programmed, that they could do an incredible variety of different tasks, calculate payrolls, compute where a rocket was going to go, trying to forecast weather. In principle, all of these machines have that generality. And we call them computers because they store information, they can compute it, they can do computations, and they are automatic. And their programs themselves are information held inside the computer. Those are the basic ideas of a computer, whatever technology you use. Mm. But of course, it's incredibly different when you can buy one for a few dollars. What you can use it for is different, and when it's thousands of times faster than the machines of 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, when you look at the various generations of what we would call modern electronic computers. From analog to digital, from going from vacuum tubes to transistors to microchips to microprocessors, aside from the fact that we have put increasing computing power in smaller and smaller packages, and that it's a technology that is now within the reach of many people, not everyone, but within the reach of many people. Are those machines, as we go through those various stages of their development, are they really different, or are they essentially the same thing? And it's just that the technology, how they work, is different.
Differences of scale, when they're great, are like differences in type. Huh. You might say both a bicycle and a jet airliner are merely means of transportation. And that's true. They're so different in their scale, in this case, in their speed. So 600 miles an hour or 15 or 20 miles an hour, they make a total difference. What you can use them for, what you can think of using them for, indeed, are so different. So in that sense, the scale, the amount of information that they can hold, where previously you might have had a little machine that could, with luck, hold all the data enough for your income tax, now a machine which can trivially hold all the information in all the books on your bookshelves, your encyclopedias, and so on. That's a difference in scale that is so different, so great, there's a difference in type.
Let's talk with someone else. Caller in Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. A couple of questions that may be more speculative, may not have any bearing at all. If so, then forget it. One, the relationship, if there is such, between when a mathematician does a proof, you know, we usually get it, you know, nicely laid out logically, but we know temporarily that probably his insights didn't come that way. And I was wondering the relationship to the history of the computer in that sense. And where is Napier's logarithm in all this? Thanks a lot.
Okay. One of the things I'd say, first of all, I would agree with you with respect to the notion of a proof. Most mathematicians, when they actually present the proof, have almost hidden the all of the false steps, all of the complications they considered, and they provide you instead with this nice, relatively simple sequence of steps, and you you go through it, and the whole idea is that you're supposed to be convinced by it, and you might even wonder, well, what was so difficult about this? And of course, they've tied it up so much. Mm-hmm. So certainly, that is true about proofs. It's also true about the task of designing a new and complicated program. You have many decisions to make. You might go down false trails, but if you then want to explain your program to somebody, say a professor explaining to students, there's a danger of presenting the design of the program, ignoring all of those all those complications, and giving them a completely false idea of how easy it was to invent that that program. Now, Napier's work. That's taking us back to the 1600s, if I remember. Napier was a Scottish mathematician. He invented logarithms. Logarithms are comparatively little used now, but when I was in school and in college, we had tables of logarithms, and we, in the simplest use, we could do multiplications, complicated multiplications, if I'm remembering correctly, by looking things up in the logarithm table, adding some numbers, looking things up in the reverse logarithm table, and getting our result. So, for centuries, those tables were crucially important. But the other thing that Napier invented were what were called Napier's bones. That's a strange name. Those were a set of four-sided wooden or ivory rods. In effect, those had the multiplication tables written on them. One rod for all the multiplications by one, another rod for the two times multiplication table, a third one for the three times multiplication table. And you would put those rods side by side in the right order. They had multiple faces, so you turn the rod to the right face. And then the task of doing multiplication was aided. Effectively, all of the single digits, 7 by 6, you didn't have to remember what the result of that was. It was there for you, showing on the rods. And that sort of little mechanism was actually designed into one very early calculator. But now Napier's rods are the thing that you will find in a museum, or are a great thing to give a small kid.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone in Bloomington, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
Hi. You were talking about differences in scale and differences in speed. Mm-hmm. And it just brings up a question about the rate that computer applications are expanding. It seems like almost every product, including the kitchen sink, contains some computer chip, some kind of a computer application. Have we reached the point where our rate of finding new computer applications is slowing down, or are we slowing down in our rate of improving the existing applications?
I think it's very unwise to assume any limit on human ingenuity. But probably a more important point than how ingenious we are is, first of all, how many people are involved. That's been growing and growing. In the early days of computers, the number of people who were programming them was measured in the first of all the tens and then in the hundreds. Now it's being measured in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. And lots of people are programming computers, are using computers in new ways, even if they don't think of themselves that way. For example, lots of accountants, people in offices, use computers to do financial calculations through what are called spreadsheets. In many cases, they will not be just taking some spreadsheet which has been given to them to do some already determined calculation, but they will have some notion of their own that they want to, some different sort of calculation, and they can effectively program that by putting formulae into their spreadsheet. So there you suddenly find hundreds of thousands of people being empowered to program. The other thing, I suppose, is that computers have been getting faster and smaller and cheaper. Yeah. And so it starts becoming feasible to think of computers in environments that you would never have thought of before. Yeah. Babbage could not have thought of having a computer on your wrist on his wrist. It was just unthinkable. But once you see the possibility of a computer on your wrist, say, you can start imagining, what could I put on there that might make sense? The most obvious thing is not just a watch. You start talking about something that might show television, something that might be monitoring perhaps your heart, your blood pressure. Who knows? So just the ability to put computers into ever more environments and to be able to afford to do so, that spurs human ingenuity.
I wholeheartedly agree. It sounds like you're saying that we may not have even scratched the surface. We've got a whole future ahead of us that just is almost beyond our imagination.
I would guess that's the case. I just need to look back through how computing has changed. I need to look back only, say, 10 years to before there was so much use of networking and things like the Internet and World Wide Web. That has totally changed many of the things I do, how I communicate with people, what sort of information I trivially obtain now in a matter of minutes. That's just mind-blowing as a change in 10 years. And I've seen quite a few 10 years' worth of changes.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, before we started going, we talked a little bit about the fact that when you talk on this subject, that one of the reasons that you suggest people might be interested in this long history of computing and computers is that by understanding where we've come from, that might help us to think about where it is, where the technology is going. Having said that, how can you talk about that? I mean, in what way does, for example, knowing a little bit about Charles Babbage perhaps give you some clue about what they will be doing, how we will use them in the years to come?
I think it would be difficult to argue that knowing about Charles Babbage is immediately relevant to guessing what will happen in the next few years. I think there are a number of reasons for being interested in computing. One of which, it's interesting. I think if there's a subject as important as computing, having as much effect, we almost owe it to the people who brought it into existence to remember them, to understand something about what they did and how they did it. That might be perhaps the main reason for knowing about Charles Babbage. I think if computing is your profession, then you're not a very well educated professional if you know nothing about how your profession came into being. I think it's fairly typical for doctors to know a number of the more famous people from the past who did things like discover how blood circulated around the body and the like. You would think of yourself as really very ill-tutored if you didn't know that. But going to the other part of your question, certainly over the last, say, 20, 30 years, I've been able to see computer revolutions which in a certain sense were not revolutionary. That there were big computers, then there were mini computers, then there were microcomputers. Each, as its name implies, much smaller than the other. But they, if you looked inside them, then logically they had a lot of similarity. And what you often found was that people were going through the same sort of sequence of developments as they were designing, say, the microcomputers, as people had gone through when they designed mini-computers. Some of those engineers did that intelligently and looked to find out what had been learnt already. Others did it painfully. When anybody reinvents the wheel, there's a grave danger of it coming out slightly squarish.
We have some other calls to talk with. Let's do that. Urbana's next, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I believe you talked about the Jacquard loom.
Yes.
Yeah. It's kind of curious that your topic touches on two nationalities. One would be the French with Joseph Marie Jacquard and his loom, which I understand is really the first programmable machine, and which preceded Babbage. And then the other one would be, which I don't think you've mentioned, is the this one is a little more dubious. I'm not, I actually picked this up from my article in the Daily Telegraph called A is for Arab. And it talks about a chief librarian of the Observatory Research Center and Library called the House of Wisdom in Baghdad, who lived in the first half of the 9th century, called Al-Khwarizmi, I think his name is. But anyway, it attributed to him the development of the algorithm, which I find a little, I don't quite understand what they meant by that. It's just a short little passage. I was just curious if you knew anything about that.
There's two or three things I can say about that. Certainly the modern word algorithm, which I suppose can be roughly translated as a procedure. In fact, a computer program is an embodiment of an algorithm, typically. And words like procedure, recipe, set of rules, algorithm are approximately the same. And that word algorithm has that... That is the name given to that concept in honor of that Arab, I guess, mathematician. Now, I am not an expert on that work, which is more in the history of mathematics than the history of computing. But it is certainly the case that the Arabs, centuries before Jacquard, one particular Arab engineer that I know of was designed a machine which, in a certain sense, was a programmed machine. The Jacquard loom, I don't think I would actually use the word program for that, but certainly it was a sequence-controlled device. The long set of cards controlling a Jacquard loom controlled the sequence in which the set of operations of the shuttle operated. I mentioned music boxes and the idea of a cylinder and a set of pins. the Arabs in about the 13th century, if I remember, fairly clearly made a device which was using that sort of cylinder, and it was used in a little model boat to entertain the royal family. And the model boat was one that was operated by water power, driving a little water mill, turning one of those little cylinders, and that caused a set of little mechanical musicians to bang on drums and also drive the boat around the little lake in front of the admiring crowd. It sounds unbelievable, but there are designs and details which are so detailed that it's obvious it was built.
That's very interesting. I didn't catch when you talked about the music boxes, but they preceded the Jacquard loom?
Musical boxes per se were later than the Jacquard loom, but the notion of a cylinder which had pegs sticking out of it, that preceded Jacquard loom by centuries. There are early, church mechanisms for playing, I think the modern term is carillon. Those go back, if I remember rightly, into the 16th century. And sometimes those sorts of devices were not used just for controlling music, but also for controlling the movement of little human figures and the like.
Yeah, one last thing, and I'll hang up, and that is that while you were speaking, it reminded me of something I saw on the History Channel, cable channel we have, and that's it was on the Romans, and it was about a box that they had cut out figures on it, and the whole it was mechanical, and it gave this little play, and it actually went through motions, and it amounted to a little theatrical play. That, and I don't know what the mechanical and programming aspects of that was, but I thought I'd bring it up in case you might have heard about it, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I don't know of a Roman play, as you call it, like that, but certainly, if I remember rightly, Hero of Alexandria devised various machines, which, yes, indeed, one could describe those as doing a complicated series of mechanisms, opening curtains, moving figures around a stage completely automatically. And I'd forgotten those when I was mentioning the later Arab. Those involved a cylinder with little pegs sticking out of it. What's important about that is you can express something very complicated just by your choice of how many pegs you put in and where you put them. Mm-hmm. But the pegged cylinder there was one that had a sort of a rope threaded around it. And what it meant was that as the cylinder turned round, the rope unwound in a complicated series of jerks, and that was what moved things around in a apparently magical way.
Let's talk with someone in Savoy. This is line 3. Hello.
Oh, hi, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, hey, I've been collecting books over the years on what I consider the main technologies of our age, and I was going to mention a couple of them here. Have you read the book about Seymour Cray, Superman?
No, I haven't read that one.
That's a great book, and that details how Seymour Cray and how he put together his concepts for the supercomputer, for the first supercomputers. And the thing that amazed me the most was some of his most advanced machines were built using like reject transistors from radio, from supply stores, and he couldn't afford the expensive ones, and so he used reject transistors, and it became an engineering problem in terms of reliability and cooling these gizmos. And it's an amazing story. He was far, far, many years ahead of his time. And then the way he approached that problem, it was at the basic level, it was very, very simple. And it could have been done probably years earlier, but he was the first one. It takes a certain kind of person to sit down and just do it. And then there's another thing that I've run across, too. I was down in Baton Rouge at Jacobs Engineering, and I wandered into a room there that was all, closed up and everything, and they had a fantastic, I mean, it was unbelievable. It was an analog computer where you program it using bread boxes and wires and potentiometers for solving engineering problems. Okay, and it was really cool.
Let me jump in there because I can react to both of your points. Seymour Cray, I certainly know about. I'm familiar with some of his work. I myself worked on the design of what we would, I guess we called then, supercomputers. I worked for IBM in the 1960s, and Seymour Cray was our main rival.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a fantastic guy, and he and a small team were outperforming what IBM and a large team were doing. When I started in computing in the 1950s, analog computers were more important than digital computers.
Right.
I should explain that a digital computer works in terms of, as its name implies, numerical digits. Typically, they're binary digits, noughts and ones, but they could equally well be the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 10. An analog computer is one that represents quantities by some analogy, like, for example, say, distance or voltage.
Right.
And the more accurately you can measure that distance or that voltage, the more accurately you can represent a number. But that puts a very severe limitation. Analog computers typically could do calculations which only involved, which a digital computer would only use, say, three digits to represent. When I started work, I was working in a company which had, I think, Europe's biggest analog computer, which occupied two floors of a building. And it was the only thing I've ever seen that really looked like what cartoonists used to draw as a computer.
Yeah,
wall of dials and so on.
Yeah, this thing down at Jacobs, it occupied a very large room, and they used it for two. And it had been used for two things. It had been used to design distillation towers. And it also the other aspect about an analog computer is they're real time. In other words, once you've got them set up, you can send disturbances into them, and then you can see how it behaves. They're real time type devices, and then you send a disturbance in, and then you can watch for the output and see how it's going to behave.
Well, you can actually program digital computers in the same way.
We do. That's one of our main pieces of. That's one of our main part business parts of our business is dynamic control.
Yeah.
Well, hey, there's another book.
Sorry, interrupting you.
But, okay, there's another book.
If that machine still exists, then. Just in case they don't know about it, tell the Computer History Museum in California about it. They might at least want to get some photographs of it.
Yeah. There's another book you ought to read, too, and I found very interesting, and it's John Bardeen's biography. It's called True Genius, and that's an amazing story there, too. Hey, I'll see you later.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We are almost out of time. One thing that I wanted to was interested in having you talk a little bit was Colossus, the British computer effort, another important chapter in the early history of computing, and something for a very long time after the war was continued to be kept secret.
Absolutely. The Colossus computer, or rather set of computers, were a set of electronic computers designed for the special purpose of breaking a particular German code, not the Enigma code, which is the one that people know about now, but an even more important code. And by the end of the war, there were 10 such computers in operation in total secrecy in the place called Bletchley Park. Those computers had of the order of 2,000 valves, tubes in them, the equivalent of 2,000 transistors. So by modern days, were incredibly simple. But they were crucial to the certain aspects of the war effort. I had the privilege of being involved in some of the declassification of that activity, and of interviewing the engineers and the mathematicians and the cryptographers who did that. That was in the 1970s, and investigating that that machine and meeting some of those people was one of the most wonderful and humbling parts of my career.
Yeah. Why was it necessary to keep that, or why was a decision made to keep that secret, well, 20 years after the war was over?
I'm always asked that question, and I usually answer that question with another one, which is, why should they release anything ever? And the British government, I think, at that stage had the idea that if we keep quiet about everything all the time, then we don't start getting into difficulties of answering questions.
All right. Well, there we will stop asking questions because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Bryant Randolph, he's emeritus professor and senior research investigator at the School of Computing Science at the University of Newcastle-upon-Tyne in the UK. He's been giving a talk on dependable pervasive systems. This is the ITI Distinguished Lecture Series on the U of I campus this afternoon at 4 in the Beckman Institute Auditorium. I'm sure anyone interested should feel welcome. Thank you very much for
Thank
being
you.
With us. The program today, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. This program also made possible by a grant from the Brown Bag Deli Restaurant, with homemade pies by Inge, gourmet foods, cards and gifts, as well as Creative Crafts, Zimmer Art Gallery, Wacky Nackies, The Buzz Cafe, Prairie Fire Glass, and Any Frequency Music Store, all located on West Washington Street in Monticello. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Gwynn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about what it's like to search for a bird many believed to be extinct, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Cornell University ornithologist Tim Gallagher and his friend Bobby Harrison sighted the bird in February 2004. It was the first time since 1944 that two qualified observers positively identified